Welcome to the Engineering Culture Podcast. This is a series focused on creating and nurturing effective teams. The Engineering Culture Podcast joins the InfoQ Podcast as a regular series brought to you by the engineers at InfoQ.com and behind the international conferences QCon. Our podcasts at InfoQ are aimed squarely at software engineers, architects, and software leaders. My name is Shane Hasty, and I'm the lead editor for Culture and Methods on InfoQ.com. At the recent Agile 2016 conference, I had the opportunity to sit down and chat with David Hussman, the dude and the founder of DevJam. Welcome. Thanks for taking the time. Now, you and I obviously know each other. Would you mind briefly introducing yourself to the audience?
I'll try, although like I'm always told I do that poorly. I think my current title is you're like product Sherpa for DevJam, but I fired up this company a decade or so ago and kind of been around the Agile space for a while. Pretty excited right now to see more people that are sort of confident in getting things done, trying to explore whether they're doing the right things. And so that's probably more where my head and DevJam's head is right now, is like, how do we move more boldly into this? I don't think we're building the right thing for the right people space.
One of the things you're known for is Dude's Law.
Yeah.
And I use it a lot when talking to people about value. Do you want to give us a little intro to that quick?
Yeah, it came up sort of as a joke. I sometimes think of controversial things to say to my wife at night to see how wrapped up she gets. And I had come from a really cool physics conference at this university by Minneapolis, and one of the brilliant Nobel laureates got up and she was talking about gravity, and it was the 100th anniversary of Einstein's publications. And I was listening to her thinking, wow, she's talking about these abstract, complex things, but she's drawing on the evidence that she has. And she was using things that were, you know, more complex versions of Ohm's Law, and I thought, you know, I can't imagine scientists sitting around contemplating Ohm's Law, and I thought, well, maybe we need something like that to ground us. So I whipped up what I thought was just a joke at night, where, you know, value equals Y divided by how. And I sort of feel like every once in a while you stumble into one of those gems. Thought it was just giving me a joke, floated it out at in a conference in Eastern Europe, and it's called Dude's Law because at that time my eldest daughter's friends all called me the Big Lebowski behind my back. But it's, you know, it's nice to hear you say that. I've heard that a lot this week from people. We use it in our retrospectives sometimes. We use it in our planning. It's been published on an internal site at SAS where someone did a proof of it. Probably the shorter answer to what you asked is, I want us to think about the intent as opposed to the process.
So that's an interesting one, the intent as opposed to the process. Where do we find that intent?
Yeah, or probably like kind of what I've been writing about lately is product over process. Mm-hmm. Impact seems to be one of the words I'm stumbling into. I see a lot of people, especially at this conference, talking about enterprise and transformation and these really big things. And I sort of don't see a lot of those transformations ever ending. And the place where I see people successful, they've latched onto a thing that impacts someone. And they're much closer to saying, did I make that person's life better? Do I understand their needs? Can I give them an option that they haven't thought of with a software product?
You said to me you're writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to give us a preview?
Well, I sort of feel like I've passed that first trimester, so I'm ready to announce that I might give birth to a book. The preview is, like I said, it's called Product Over Process. I was trying to riff off the Agile Manifesto. I was talking to Ward one time, and he did what he does really well, is he said, we just kind of stumbled into this over that language, which I think is nice because it's a comparative sort of value statement, but not overly judgy. And it sort of starts out with like, okay, well, where do we go with all this stuff we've done in the last 10 years if we've sort of come close to killing the word agile? And it starts out with that. Then it sort of steps into, if you believe that product is something to latch onto that you can validate to make enterprise change, what is the right mapping between the teams and the products and their tech? Because I think that's what's sometimes people assume to be there. Like it's one team, one tech stack, one product. And that's very few of what I work in, for a few examples.
I've heard that called the Cinderella Project.
Yeah. right? Or maybe it's the product unicorn or something of that nature. So then the book sort of starts out saying, okay, well, if you're a group of people that are in that little unicorn space, but you're maybe overly focused on delivery, how do you set up sort of a blended delivery discovery cadence where they interweave and inform each other? And then once you think about that from a basic perspective, how do you extrapolate that into one product and many teams? And then the most complex ecosystem I'm in are these companies that don't necessarily say the word product. They have a big system that they configure for people. And that the product idea is not as obvious because it's not sort of a B2C web, e-commerce-y thing.
Mm-hmm. So how do we overcome the complexity that's in that beast?
This is a nice word, complexity. I sort of warm to that because I feel like ever since Fred Brooks said accidental complexity, that really stuck with me. In fact, I was talking to one of the coaches at Intel one time, and he said, I don't think it's accidental complexity. I think it's incidental complexity. Like, there's that moment where things happen, we don't understand what's around us, and we just inject complexity. I think in the product realm, what happens is when people don't see an obvious mapping between product and teams, they sometimes end up with a lot of scrum teams, and what's cross-cutting is the product. And so in that larger ecosystem, I think if we can constrain it with things like small product slices like MVP, or even smaller things like customer journeys, which I've been thinking of as minimum viable learning, then we can constrain complexity to make it merely complicated. Because complicated is more solvable than complexity. Complexity, I don't think, is something you solve, you only wield.
That's an interesting term, minimum viable learning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you extrapolate?
Or interpolate, possibly. I when I read the Lean Startup stuff, what I was really inspired by was terms like validated learning. And I love the idea of eliminating uncertainty. I worked a little bit with a food group. And with that food group, they start out with, they're designing new food. They start out with like 200 ideas. And their goal isn't to get stuff done. Their goal is to narrow the ideas down to a subset that they can experiment against. So it feels like both groups, without knowing each other, came to the same level. One of the struggles I see with MVP is that people overcomplicate it as in to get something done fast. And it's always been, for me, about learning and validation. So product oftentimes tends to be a big chunk. And I don't think the Lean Startup people were going for that. But I started using story mapping and personas and things to try and say, what's a minimal thing that we could put in front of someone and validate it, maybe not release it into production? And that's why I like this minimum viable learning, because it puts that word learning forward again.
But now there was an interesting point in there, not release it to production.
Yeah. So that's sort of what I meant by like this blended discovery and delivery. So you hear more people talking about discovery and product discovery. And I think there's, I've saw it as an evolution of people that are confident in the delivery space. You see them starting to say, well, what can we learn, for lack of a better term, outside of the code, outside of production? And for me, that was such a bad experience in the 90s, like prototype meant crappy code that we shipped and then suffered through. But we can do the different things right now if you just take things that are possible in JavaScript-y land, where you can produce something that's pretty significant and it's not a bait and switch. What if we establish like this intentional discovery cadence that feeds a delivery cadence without going back to sort of design and development land? And we start saying, what do we think we could narrow the certainty around, or narrow the uncertainty around, outside of the delivery space? Showing things to people, real-time prototypes, A/B testing, customer interviews, more software developers moving towards being product developers, with sort of the definition of like the intent is to sort of learn what people's needs are, and you can validate some of that outside of the code. It's a hard thing for some people that are really steeped in getting stuff done to think about, because I think what they hear is waterfall for some reason.
So how is it different from the traditional, do the design up front, don't start anything until you know everything, which is wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I have been trying to have that discussion with different people that were uncomfortable with learning in shorter cycles for a long time. And I think the difference is the percentage of time spent in design and discovery. So you hear people at the conference here talking about design sprints. If you use that language and a design sprint informs a delivery sprint, and the information flows back up, it's sort of like you're narrowing the level of uncertainty in the design sprint and you're validating more things in the delivery sprint, but then it feeds back up into that. So it's more an ebb and flow as opposed to big serialized events. The way I've sort of been communicating it to leaders for a while without all those words is traditionally we did analysis and design, which was 50% of 100%, because we had to understand everything, then we just had to build it. And I think this is more of a cadence where we're trying to get like 100% of 10% done. So we can figure out, is the other 90% a good investment? But I even slipped there and I used the word done. So I should have said 100% of 10% validated. Because it's a simple linguistic change, but I think it's significant.
The difference between done and validated.
The easiest way is for you and I to imagine we're sitting with a group that's really steeped in this delivery stuff, and they have sort of a left to right view up on the wall that's a Kanban board, and the last column says done. So what I saw a lot of people that were confident about that start doing is add another column that says validated. And then you really get an interesting discussion if you say, hey, let's not pull things in until we know how we're going to be validated. It sort of turns into like test-driven product. And then like what we're doing at DevJam right now is this idea I have of impact-driven development, where I want the developers to say, how are you going to measure that? If it's a web solution, you could use something like Mixpanel. So they're not trying to get it done. They're trying to move it into one of these ecosystems, either validation, early validation and discovery, or production validation and delivery, to say, I got that out there. Is it having the impact I want? Where I think done usually means I got it out there. And most of the product managers are like, great, I'm glad you showed up for the game. Now we got to win.
Yeah, because in many, many organizations, done is, oh, get it off my hands.
Yeah. Even that sigh, kind of, I got it done. Yeah,
that's it. Never mind that somebody's now got to take this thing and get the impact that we were looking for. But how many organizations are able to link that sort of impact to these stories and slices?
Right, and that's sort of why I think this understanding, this mapping of like teams and things and tech, where things to me are products or services, because there are a lot of ecosystems I work in where service is the product. So it doesn't just, thing is probably not a great word, but it seems to be neutral enough. I think we're sort of back in the same space we were when like extreme programming and stuff started, where there's a handful of small, naturally nimble groups that are already sort of doing this. You know, if you look at the chaos and the intuition engineering stuff that's happened in Netflix, the level of confidence in their tech stack is such that we are going to get stuff done. Our environments are going to be up. Their environments are almost anti-fragile. Mm-hmm. So now they feel more confident to explore. And God, imagine like all the interesting data and evidence Netflix has, but there's a really good like TED Talk that talks about like House of Cards versus the same show created by another company, and how Netflix balanced intuition and evidence to make those choices. So I probably, back to your question, I think these smaller shops that have one thing, one tech stack, and one team, group of people greenfielding something in Python or Rails or something like that, or a mobile app, it's almost a natural fit. But it's a huge slope from there to an organization that has 10 teams building one thing. Harder to get those teams, there's less confidence in the delivery space. I think what they hear is, we can't have people involved in this discovery stuff because we'll get less done.
So how do you convince them?
Some days poorly. On my better days when I'm patient, what I always try to do is go into an organization and figure out, you know, where they have what Nassim Taleb calls evidence of success. So instead of telling them how wonderful what we're going to do is, if there's already something there, then immediately you have context to point to. If they don't have any of that, I think you have to find a starting place, which sort of goes back to where you started, because if I'm in a web-only ecosystem or a mobile-first ecosystem, that's very different than working with, on the other end of the spectrum, a company that builds medical devices, because you can't just run random tests. The FDA frowns on that in the States. So I think finding a starting place that's not so complex that we can't apply some constraints to wield it in, but also not just picking some kind of cream puff that doesn't really show anything of significance. As dangerous as it might be, I feel like the people we need to show significance to are often not in that delivery space. They're the people on the outside, some of which still think that, you know, software product development is a constructionist effort.
Yeah, there's an engine room here, just do it.
Yes, just, can you just, that's a funny word to listen for. Well, we just have to do this, right?
What about the even more complex space? I'm thinking of some of the organizations I work with, large banks.
Right.
You've got multiple teams, multiple products, and many-to-many relationships between them in all sorts of horrible ways.
Yeah, and the many-to-many piece is really powerful. And maybe another segmentation that's sort of in that sentence is when you go into a company that's a product company, or like more of a late 20th, early 21st century mobile first, e-first company, the sense of product is more obvious. Other ecosystems, telecoms, larger insurance companies, banks, the idea of product isn't as obvious. But if you go sit with someone that works in the bank or someone that's in the retail side of the bank, they definitely talk about products in use. So I think in that ecosystem, how do you take what is more of an IT world? In the IT space, I think people tend to, whether they say it out loud, think in project. Project is more time. In fact, the book had a name that was called Process or Products Over Projects, but I put process in because it's the same thing. So that's where like maybe the minimum viable learning thing comes in. How can I frame something up that starts to look producty, that servicey, something that we can validate? And it's harder in big systems because a lot of times there's four layers of teams. The telecoms have these guys down at the bottom doing this switching stuff, and not only will they never see a person, they probably don't see light very often. And it's like the embedded stuff in the medical device. Their stuff is really complex, you know? So I think that's where the teams, things, and tech come in, because usually in those bigger systems, there's a tech stack. Like one of the really common ones I see is SAP at the bottom. Sitting on top of that might be like a Java or a .NET solution or something else. Sitting on top of that might be, you know, a JavaScript-y web thing, a mobile thing, and now an IoT thing. And you're not going to get the little IoT geek that loves to bang that code digging around in the ABAP. So you immediately have a separation, which is techs and teams. And what you said before is some essence of thing, product, or service that's validatable, viable, is a really nice way to start teasing that out of an IT systems-based ecosystem.
So that whole customer journey or device journey, if we're talking an IoT thing.
Right.
One transaction all the way through.
So, and that's where this whole idea of like this upstream product discovery is like, for years and years in that device space or in the web space or in the client space, we started stubbing things out. But I don't think we wielded the tech stack very well. So we would show something to someone, and then when we plugged in all the technology, it was like, well, we can't do that. And if we cut down that delivery cycle and we get more determinism in that space, I sort of feel like in the delivery space, we can make things more discrete and deterministic. It doesn't mean they're not going to be complicated, but we can wield the complexity. That's been brilliant about all the things that like Kent Beck and Ward sort of brought into the world. It's like we can own that space. If we can do some discovery up here, we might be able to figure out how to push fewer of the less interesting ideas, the less certain ideas into that space, see if we can validate them outside. In fact, I've been working with a chemical engineer who then went on to work for Amazon, and she and I are exploring how to pragmatically apply design of experiment in the digital space, which is really exciting to me, because she comes from this ecosystem where there's complexity and experimentation. You can't just say, let's run an experiment. She's going to ask you,
with what parameters?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a neat discovery discussion, though.
Well, Dave, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been really interesting. And where can people get hold of you?
Probably the easiest place is devjam.com or Twitter. I'm at David Hussman. I wander around Minneapolis a lot, but it's cold there in the winter.
Thanks very much.
All right, my pleasure.